healthy alternatives. Both research and real-life experiences are making it clear every day that our traditional medical system and practices need to be rethought, revised, and recharged in light of a more holistic approach to health. Dr. Jerry V. Teplitz, host of Healthy Alternatives, has been a pioneer for 36 years in stress management and optimum health. With a Ph.D. in holistic health sciences, a law degree, and as the author of 8 books, all focused on health, stress management, and performance, Dr. Teplitz is uniquely qualified to help us explore and incorporate healthy alternatives into our daily lives. He is a professional speaker and has shared his wisdom with over 1 million people. Join him to reach your highest level of health and wellness. Now, here's Dr. Teplitz.
Welcome to Healthy Alternatives. My name is Dr. Jerry Teplitz, and you're listening to WebTalkRadio.net. What Healthy Alternatives is about is the desire that we really all have to have optimum health, optimum wellness. You want to feel better, live longer, enjoy life more, and that's what Healthy Alternatives is attempting to bring to you. Every week I like to begin the show by talking about an issue or concern you should know about because it can have a real impact on your life. This is from a study published in the Journal of American Medical Association. Back in 2007, there was some research reported that showed when you have people who have chest pains, but it's not an emergency type of thing where they're having a heart attack, that if they did angioplasty to prevent that potential heart attack, it improved their survival rate and relieved discomforts in the long run. The research also showed that drug treatments did the exact same thing, and it didn't cost anywhere near as much. It didn't have the potential for harming the person, and it was very effective. So that was back in 2007. So you'd think nowadays docs would be using this drug side before they use angioplasty. Ain't that way at all. This new study that was just published looked at nearly 500,000 U.S. patients with artery blockages, but they were stable in effect, so it wasn't an emergency situation between 2005 and mid-2009. Two-thirds had chest pain. They all eventually got artery opening stents during an angioplasty. Now, before this original study that was done, fewer than half of the treatments, the patients received this drug treatment first. They go to angioplasty. 2 years after the study, there was only a tiny increase of the patients who were given the drug treatment first. What that means is that they're still being given angioplasty when the drug treatment is safer and cheaper. How much cheaper? Well, angioplasties cost about $20,000. The medication used, you can just get generics of aspirin, beta blockers, statins. So the cost is negligible compared to the cost of an angioplasty. Now, the other part that the recommendation was that all patients, if they did have an angioplasty, should get the drug treatment afterwards to help prevent heart surgery. And at the original time the study was done, almost a third were not given medications after their angioplasty. Well, this new study shows nothing's changed. So we've got a situation going on where docs are out there and people are, in effect, receiving angioplasties that they don't actually need and paying a heck of a lot for it. How many? About 1 million angioplasties a year are done, and half of them are with people who have this stable heart condition who don't need it. If you go into your doc and they say that you need an angioplasty done, ask them if they've read the latest study in the Journal of the American Medical Association on the use of drugs instead. While I'm not the biggest proponent of drugs, in this case, it's a heck of a lot better than surgery. Today, I'm going to be talking to the author of Mixing Minds, The Power of Relationship in Psychoanalysis and Buddhism. We're going to be looking at ways that you can enrich both the mind and the spirit to understand how those two systems, Buddhism, Western psychology, can actually support each other, how they differ from each other, but how you can use them to assist in your own personal development and growth. If you want to know more about me, you can click on the globe on this page or go to teplitz.com. You can also sign up for a monthly newsletter that I do by going to teplitz.com. On the home button, click there and you'll see where you can then go in and sign up. You can also follow me on Twitter and Facebook. Every week I also like to talk to you about a healthy breakthrough. It's new discoveries, latest information about healthy alternatives that you can use for yourself, your family, and loved ones. What I want to talk about now are video games. Now, there's been research done that showed that children who play video games an average of 31 hours a week show increased anxiety, depression, and social phobia, and that their school grades decline. Some of the children, they show hostile behavior. Well, how would this be a healthy alternative? It turns out that some of the latest research shows that girls who play video games with their parents are generally better behaved and show lower rates of depression than those who don't. This is a study published in the Journal of Adolescent Health. Now, they didn't see this result in boys, and possibly because boys are more likely to play games in which the players compete against one another, whereas girls are more likely to play collaborative games such as Rock Band, in which the players work together. And the positive effects occur in this study when the parents, and it's usually primarily the father, because the mothers tend not to play games, that this benefit occurs. And the study looked at 287 families with children from 11 to 16 and found this difference going on with the girls, to the extent the American Academy of Pediatrics has suggested parents can lessen negative effects of media, including video games, by joining their children in viewing or playing those games. So take a look at this notion. If you got a girl, pick up that controller, do that X-Bot, just get involved, and you'll actually be able to help them. Before I bring on my guest, I'd like to pause for this message.
Anyone who has migraines knows that they are almost totally debilitating and hard, if not impossible, to treat. Or should we say they were impossible to treat? Dr. Jerry Teplitz's DVD, Instant Headache and Migraine Relief, delivers on its promise with a 5-minute migraine cure and a 90-second headache treatment. Learn this natural way to get rid of your migraine with the 2,000-year-old Japanese technique of shiatsu, a pressure point method that's simple and immediately effective. The Instant Headache and Migraine Relief DVD also features bonus techniques for treating sore throats, stiff necks, and shoulder pain. No pills, no herbs, no waiting, just relief. Jack Canfield, co-author of the Chicken Soup for the Soul series, learned these techniques from Dr. Teplitz and says, these techniques are so practical, so powerful, so simple. They've done it for me and my family. They can do it for you too. Click on the DVD cover on the page in front of you for more information. Instant Headache and Migraine Relief comes with a 60-day money-back guarantee. There's no reason to wait. Click on it now.
My guest today is Pilar Jennings. Pilar has a PhD in psychiatry and religion from Union Theological Seminary, and she's been working with patients and families through the Harlem Family Institute since 2004. Dr. Jennings is also a researcher at Columbia University Center for the Study of Science and Religion. She's a long-term practitioner of Tibetan and Vipassana Buddhism. And she's also trained as a Buddhist chaplain through the Zen Center for Contemplative Care, and she's recently authored Mixing Minds, The Power of Relationships in Psychoanalysis and Buddhism. And Pilar, welcome to Healthy Alternatives.
Thank you, Jerry. It's good to be here.
So Mixing Minds, The Power of Relationships, Psychoanalysis and Buddhism. First of all, how did you get involved with the Buddhism part? Because, you know, you've got your degrees in psychiatry and religion. How did that come about for you?
Well, I was introduced to Buddhism fairly early in life. I have a spiritually curious mother who brought me to a variety of religious communities and temples, and one of them was a Buddhist meditation center. So I was about 9 or 10 years old, And it was my first exposure to Eastern contemplative practices, and it just felt lovely to me. I really enjoyed being in silence with other adults, which was not an experience I had had before, and it just stuck. You know, it seemed like a good match for my personality and my interests.
And then where did the psychoanalysis, kind of that part in the psychiatry, come from?
Well, I've obviously been very influenced by my mother. She is also a psychoanalyst.
Your mother did it, huh? This is you need a therapist, lady.
Yeah, I know, it's terrible. I would say she introduced me to these traditions, and they weren't actively integrated for her. She doesn't self-define as a Buddhist. She's ethnically Jewish, was raised in Peru, sent to Catholic school, so I think curious about religion and spirituality, generally speaking. I became much more focused on Buddhism. I think, as I said before, it felt like a good match for my temperament and my personality. At the same time, I think because I'm a New Yorker and because I have a parent who's an analyst, I was very curious about the psychological elements of Buddhist practice and the ways in which Western psychotherapy and Eastern spirituality might be in conversation.
And so there's a notion that you have of looking at relationships and its relevancy to religion. How does that play out in this, what you're talking about?
Well, I think an area of common ground between religion and therapy is the focus on relationship. And both of these systems for making meaning and for healing are very much about reinforcing our relationship to our own selves as well as to the world beyond self. So when I started to think about writing Mixing Minds, I really wanted to focus on the way in which relationship is used as a healing methodology within these two traditions, but also the way in which relationship is basically the goal. So it's increased sense of connection to oneself and also to where meaning lies beyond the self. And I think this is true for both traditions.
So you're defining relationship as your internal relationship to you, but also then there's the part where your relationship relating to the other.
Exactly.
And so, because I don't usually view Buddhism as a relationship to other, but you find that that's a part of that as well?
Yeah, it's a foundational teaching in the Dharma is interdependence or dependent origination, that everything exists in dependence upon changing causes and conditions, including our own self. Our bodies, our identities, they're not fixed in nature. They're not rigid or absolute. You know, they're informed by myriad factors and people and situations. And so in reality, we are profoundly independent upon others throughout our lives. And that's something that's really underscored in Buddhism as well as in psychotherapy.
Now, in terms of the two together, are there times you would send somebody who came in as a patient client in the Buddhism direction, sometimes you send the psychoanalytical direction, or sometimes both? Does it vary as to which direction you're sending and what would make the variance?
Well, when I'm in the role of therapist, I tend not to be educational with my patients, so I rarely make explicit my own religious practice unless they ask. You know, if they ask, I won't dodge the question. I know some therapists might play it uber Freudian, but I prefer just to be direct. And so if they get the sense intuitively, because I think most patients are very intuitive, that I have some interest in spirituality, I would be honest with them about the healing potential in meditation practice and how it's a way, it's one tool for addressing the psyche, and has been very helpful for many people with anxiety, with depression. But unless they asked, I would probably not present it until it was, you know, a conscious interest in the patient. That said, some of my mentors are less shy, and I respect them for that. So if they have a patient, for instance, who's riddled with anxiety and they're taking anxiety medication and it's not helping, or it's not helping to the degree they would like, they might suggest to them that in addition to therapy and potentially medication, they could also try some kind of spiritual practice, some way to still the mind and really look within. And meditation is one tool that's been very helpful for lots of people. So,
I was just going to ask you, are you aware of differences in doing different types of meditation? Like there's transcendental meditation, Buddhist meditation, Tai Chi has an element of meditation in it, Hatha Yoga has it. Are you aware of differences in those different types of meditation in terms of the benefits that people get?
There are differences, which is why I think being curious about the differences is very helpful for people who have some wish to explore meditation, to try out different modalities and see what's most helpful for them. Because some methods they're pretty spare. You know, you're sitting with the breath. You're really just sitting, just being with the mind. There's no chanting involved. It's very still. And for some people, that's an extremely powerful practice that helps them go deeper into their own inner life very quickly. There are other forms of meditation that are livelier, that involve chanting and prayer and song. And for other people with different personalities, that kind of approach to contemplative practice might work better. So it's more discursive, it's more dynamic. And since we all have such different personalities, I think it makes sense to just be curious about what the different tools are within these traditions.
So for the person who can't sit in one place too long, doing a sitting meditation may be the wrong direction to go.
Well, I think that's true of most of us. I mean, particularly if we're contemporary Americans, we're inundated with stimuli and we like it. You know, it's fun to have all these ideas and these computers and these gadgets, and none of us, generally speaking, are that good at just sitting and being with our own minds, mm-hmm. which is why I think it's a healthy challenge to just see what happens if we're in stillness, if we're not listening to music, if we're not engaging in conversation, but we're just being, to see what comes up.
There was actually a research study that I saw a number of years ago comparing a mantra meditation where you say words over and over again to saying the word one on the exhalation, and mm-hmm. also mm-hmm. compared it to progressive relaxation. Mm-hmm. And they found that the one where you said the mantra, they all three got people to the same physiological level, but the one that had the longest retention in terms of people staying with it over time, and this particular study turned out to be the mantra meditation, where they were repeating some words over and over, not the word one, but some other Sanskrit type words, which are ancient words. I found that as an interesting difference when you start looking long term at outcomes for folks. So we're going to take a break for a moment, and we're going to come back to talk more with you. So I'd like to remind listeners that you're listening to Healthy Alternatives with Dr. Jerry Teplitz on webtalkradio.net. And we'll get back to my guest, Dr. Pilar Jennings, and talking about her book, Mixing Minds, The Power of Relationships in Psychoanalysis and Buddhism. Be back in a moment.
I want to let you know about some seminars that I'm going to be doing in June. One is Switched On Selling, Switched On Network Marketing, which both take place on June 10th in Norfolk, Virginia. These are brain rewiring approaches to more effective selling. It goes along with the book that I've done, the number one Amazon bestseller, Switched On Selling, Balance Your Brain for Sales Success. On June the 14th and 15th, I'm doing the Switched On Management version of those classes. If you'd like more information about those, you can give us a call at 800-77 and then the word RELAX, R-E-L-A-X, or you can email us at info@teplitz.com and we'd be delighted to get you more information. You can also become a certified instructor of my trainings. Those will be June 10th through the 12th for selling and network marketing and 13th through 15th for Switched On Management. Again, you can call 800-77-RELAX or you can email us at info@teplitz.com.
So I'm talking today to Pilar Jennings. She has a PhD in psychiatry and religion from Union Theological Seminary. She's been working since 2004 at the Harlem Family Institute. She's also a researcher at Columbia University Center for Study of Science and Religion. She's a long-term practitioner of Tibetan and Vipassana meditation. And she's been trained as a Buddhist chaplain through the Zen Center for Contemplative Care. Her latest book is Mixing Minds, The Power of Relationships in Psychoanalysis and Buddhism. So I've got a question for you, Pilar, on we're talking about some of the similarities between Buddhism and psychoanalysis, looking at self, looking at other. What are some of the differences between the two?
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, there are many differences. I would say one of the primary differences is the object of focus. So in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis, there's a strong focus on personal experience. So the ways in which individually we respond to our particular family systems, our particular care providers, our particular sociocultural milieu. It's very personal, and subjectivity is honored as an important area of focus. In Buddhism, in contrast, the perspective is more universal. So it's less focused on the ways in which an individual person might have interacted with an individual mother or father, and more interested in the ways in which we all, regardless of culture or gender or any identity marker, have a similar experience of self and similar struggles to transcend the trappings of self. So it has a tendency to zoom out and look at universal human experience, whereas psychotherapy tends to really zoom in and look at the nuances of individual experience. So that's one difference.
So when you say Buddhism is kind of zooming out, is it actually actively zooming out, or is it just through the meditative process, whatever comes up is more in that bigger picture? So is it actually talking like you would with a therapist about bigger picture issues, or is it just all internal?
Well, in the teachings, the focus is on universal common denominators, so the ways in which we all have a tendency to get lost in our self-experience, or the ways in which we all struggle to really get curious about why we suffer, or the ways in which we all suffer for similar reasons. Whereas in psychotherapy, of course, there's a general understanding of what creates suffering and how people struggle, but the effort is not to generalize and instead to really look at the intricacies of how a particular person has suffered. So the theory is very different.
Okay. Is there a difference between what I'll call American Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism?
There is. I mean, of course, there are many different types of American Buddhists practicing in a variety of different lineages. But generally speaking, many American Buddhists have been attracted to what's referred to as secular or agnostic Buddhism, where it's somewhat decontextualized from its historical roots. And the intention is to try and reduce the religious trappings of the teachings and really create something that's very accessible for Americans so that they can reap the benefits of the spiritual practice. Traditional Tibetan Buddhism feels much more overtly religious. Mm-hmm. There are prayers and prostrations and all sorts of ornate hand gestures, and you're very aware that you've entered into a religion that doesn't hail from this country. So, you know, there's more that has to be grappled with culturally. But I think that's a healthy challenge for many Americans to really have a look at what they're doing.
So would you still label the American version a religion, or has it been successful in kind of secularizing, as you're saying?
Well, it's been a hot topic since I published Mixing Minds. I've had the good fortune to interact with a number of American Buddhists teaching here, many of whom are wonderful teachers who are active in secular communities. I think for me, I'm very interested in what might get dropped when American Buddhists understand their practice to be purely secular or to not be religious in nature. And it's not that I can't see the value, because I think there are many American Buddhists who come to Buddhism having had negative experiences in their prior faith traditions. So the last thing they want is to feel like they're stuck in another religious community with unhealthy teachers or acting out or hypocrisy. But I think when we conflate religion with bad behavior, it prevents us from really grappling with the fruits of religion or what's potentially healing in religion. And in Mixing Minds, I argue that religion is much like marriage. It's not inherently any one thing. It's simply receiving the consciousness of the people who practice it. So if you're in a healthy religious community, you're not going to find the coercion and the acting out that you would find in an unhealthy religious community. So, you know, my call is for people to not be too reductive about religion too soon and just get curious about what it might be.
With the Buddhist, American Buddhism, it seems you're saying is that they've been mostly successful,
mm-hmm.
but that it have they gone too far and been too successful and miss some of that you're talking about, the healthy part of religion?
Yeah, I think you put it very well. I mean, we were talking about dependency before, which is such a foundational part of Buddhism, this idea that we are profoundly dependent upon one another for everything. And I think that's the real gift of religion, is how to experience that dependency in a healthy way. So to have religious mentors, to have community, to have friends that we feel held by and cared for. If we're not practicing that dependency, then there's a way in which we can unknowingly be defending ourselves, right? Protecting ourselves from harm. And I wonder at times if in secular Buddhism, that fear, that unconscious fear, might not be addressed. So, you know, that's just one issue that I'm curious about.
A big question here: does the American version of psychoanalysis therapy actually work?
It's another good question. And as a clinician, I would say absolutely. You know, I have experienced having been a patient and on the other side as a clinician, how powerful this tradition is in terms of helping people really come to appreciate the complexity of what they have lived through and why they suffer in particular ways. And that insight can have an incredibly healing impact where people feel less ashamed by their struggles. They have more compassion for themselves because they understand their struggles more. So I think it's a very powerful method. That said, I think there's room for growth, and there's a way in which psychoanalysis and psychotherapy have tended to shy away from the realm of happiness and real thriving. And that's tended to be in the domain of religion and spirituality. So part of why I wrote Mixing Minds was just to encourage a deepening curiosity from therapists and analysts about how they might be able to bring in the realm of happiness to the clinical space.
And there you're also talking about bringing in, I think it's called positive psychology, as a possible addition. Would that be correct?
Well, I think just the notion that our suffering could end, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I think when
praise the Lord.
That's right. Hallelujah. Hopefully today.
Yeah.
I think, you know, generally speaking, when people go to therapy, of course, they want to address whatever it is that's causing them the most pain. So whatever symptom or whatever struggle is making life unmanageable. But I think at the same time, they really want the good life, right? I mean, they want to live into their talents and their potential. They want to feel special. They really want that good, thriving life that they've fantasized about. So without being Pollyanna, I'd love therapists to hold that up as a real possibility. So not just to survive our traumas, but to really move into thriving, rich lives.
And on that thriving, rich notion, where can people get your book, Mixing Minds, The Power of Relationship in Psychoanalysis and Buddhism, Pilar?
It's available on Amazon as well as in local Barnes & Noble bookshops and independent bookstores as well. And if
Great.
They have more questions, they can go to my site at www.pilarjennings.com.
And Pilar is P-I-L-A-R.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you for being a guest today on Healthy Alternatives.
Thank you, Jerry. I've enjoyed it.
Next week, my guest will be Anna Wolfenden. Anna has been a wellness educator and writer for 30 years, communication education wellness director for the Heritage Store for 20 years. The Heritage Store is a place that produces a tremendous amount of formulas developed by a gentleman called Edgar Cayce, who was called the Sleeping Prophet. Some people have called him the father of holistic medicine. This is going to be very different, very interesting, and very exciting interview with Anna. You're not going to want to miss this one. This is Dr. Jerry Teplitz, and you can find out more about me at teplitz.com or follow me on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for being with us today for Healthy Alternatives. For more information about Dr. Teplitz and his availability for speaking engagements, please click on the globe on the webtalkradio.net page in front of you or go to teplitz.com. You may also follow him on Facebook and Twitter by using the icons on the page. To find out more about his books, please click on any of the book covers you see. Eat well, rest well, take a breath, get some exercise, and we'll see you again right here next week for another edition of Healthy Alternatives.